My name is Jean Balance, and I'm here to help moderate a Kulin Internet seminar entitled OSC Readiness Presents, Increasing the Use of Poison Sensors for Public Health Surveillance and Response, a CDC and ATSDR Perspective. This session has been sponsored by EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, which is the same program where I work in Washington, D.C. For those of you who are joining us on the telephone lines, I'm going to cover a couple of basic housekeeping items. Some of these instructions will apply specifically to phone participants, others to those of you streaming the audio online. Regardless of your audio choice, though, you want to be sure that you have a copy of the presentation materials open in front of you today. When you signed up for today's seminar, you would have been directed to the homepage or unique URL that is specific to today's event that had a complete description of our session, contact information for both myself and our presenters, as well as links to download a copy of the presentation materials as either PowerPoint or PDF. There's also a button that appears on the left side of that page that says Go to Seminar, which will allow you to pull the slides up in a web browser window. So it doesn't matter which approach you take, but you want to be sure to have a copy of those materials open in front of you today and that everyone's looking at slide number one, the title slide. I'm going to direct everyone to move along to slide number two, which is our housekeeping slide. And if you haven't picked on it just yet, with Kulin Internet seminars, each individual participant will be expected to manually move through the materials at verbal cues from our presenters today. So for those of you who are joining us on the telephone line, again, I'm on slide number two, we would ask that you place your phone line on mute. You can use your own mute button or simply hit star six to mute your line. We will take breaks for questions and answers with our presenters. We're going to allow our first presenter to speak, and then we'll take a break to answer questions regarding his presentation. Then we'll move on to the second presentation and then take a break to answer questions for him and then any other outstanding questions that may still be out there before we conclude today's session. So at that time, you'll be invited to go off of mute, but until then, please keep your phone lines on mute, again, using your own mute button or star six. Do not put the call on hold. If you have to, simply disconnect, and you'll feel free to dial back in when you can. Placing the call on hold could have commercials or unwanted music that will be disruptive. So just keep yourselves on mute until then. For those of you that are streaming the audio online, muting won't be an issue, but when it comes to asking a question or reporting a technical difficulty, you won't be asking them out loud. Instead, you're going to take advantage of some of the icons that you see on the top of the web browser version of the slides. If you're looking at the slides online, you'll see a series of numbered links that appear to the left, and those links will help you to navigate through the materials. Again, I'm on slide number two for those of you just joining us today. You'll also see a series of orange buttons along the top of the slides. The single arrow pointing to the right will advance you one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left moves you backwards one slide. If you'd like to ask a question or submit a comment or even report a technical problem, you want to click the icon that has a question mark in it. Please be sure to have your pop-up blockers disabled because the question form will actually open up in a new window. You can type up your comment or question. And then when we get to those breaks for Q&A, I'll read your questions out loud to the presenters so that they can answer them. We would encourage you to go ahead and submit your questions or comments as soon as they occur to you. That way we can build a nice queue up. When we take that break for Q&A, I'll go ahead and read the questions out loud. Again, you can also use that same form to submit any technical difficulties. We have had one person comment on different versions or different slide sets, and you will note that for today's talk, we have two distinct presentations that are being given. So you will notice as we move through the materials that the slides will change as we move from one presenter to the other, but it is all part of one particular file set. Today's session is being recorded and will be archived, and when we're all done with today's presentation, I'll point everybody to a few resources, our feedback form, and again, remind you how you'll be able to access the recording once it's available. When we close things out, again, there'll be a chance to fill out a short feedback form, so I would encourage you to do so. We'll also provide information on how you can download a number of the reference materials that will be talked about throughout today's presentation. In fact, one of our presenters will be referencing a Word document, and that document can be found, if you'd like to, download it in advance on the resources or links page associated with today's seminar. I think that's the end of the formal technical reminders that I have for everybody today, so I'll go ahead and officially introduce our presenters. Again, you're here for a Kulin seminar, which is going to look at increasing the use of poison sensors for public health surveillance and response, a CDC and ATSDR perspective. Representatives from the CDC National Center for Environmental Health will discuss the national surveillance capability to better detect and respond to chemical, environmental, drug, foodborne, biological, and radiological exposures and illnesses of potential public health significance using the National Poison Data System, or NPDS. The National Poison Data System is owned and operated by the American Association of Poison Control Centers, AAPCC, and since 2001, the CDC and AAPCC have developed methods to use the NPDS data for near real-time surveillance of exposures to hazardous substance of potential public health significance. The Agency for Toxic Substance and Disease Registry, or ATSDR, will present increasing the use of poison centers by the Federal and State Response Team, or ROT, in Region 6 to provide medical and public health support. It will highlight the development of the Poison Control Activation Guidance document and communication through the RRT6 and the use of the Poison Center 24/7 hotline by the EPA Federal On-Scene Coordinators during a hazmat response. We'll be joined by two presenters today. Our first presenter will be Patrick Young, who works for the Agency for Toxic Substances Disease Registry, or ATSDR. And our second presenter will be Royal Law from the CDC National Center for Environmental Health. So I'm going to go ahead and officially kick today's technical presentation off. I'm going to direct all of our participants to go ahead and move along to slide number 3. And I'll turn things over to Patrick Young to begin the presentation.
Thank you, Jean. I know Royal and myself are very excited to be here with this audience. I'm going to take the field approach and kind of talk a little bit about ATSDR and where we fit into the EPA world, and then talk a little bit about myself learning about the Poison Control Center and implementing a program in Region 6. And then Royal is going to kind of take the information of the region and moving it more to a national perspective of the data that's actually generated by this talk. So thank you very much for the opportunity. I know these are challenging on these presentations. I'm going to kind of wing through some of these slides. I don't want to read any of the slides, and I don't have any notes, so I'm just going to take a lot of this information off of my head. I think it's a little bit more challenging for me and probably a little bit better as a presenter as I sit in this cube and provide this presentation. So we'll move forward to the next slide. Just a quick disclaimer, and just wanted to point out that the information provided herein is opinion of the author and does not represent the opinions or the policy of ATSDR or EPA. Next slide, please. So ATSDR, we are under the Department of Health and Human Services. We are administered by the Centers for Disease Control, and we recently combined with the National Centers for Environmental Health, or NCEH for short. You'll notice 1980, where it's right behind the acronym for ATSDR. Congress created ATSDR in 1980, and our mission is to do health assessments, public health assessments on Superfund sites or hazardous waste sites. So that's where we were created. And if you go to the next slide, please. One of our primary roles is assist in site-specific investigations to follow up on actions, public health actions at Superfund sites. Because of our public health assessment work, we can also do health consultations for non-Superfund sites, and we can also be petitioned by what I like to refer to as maybe the mom and pops, or the citizen can actually petition our agency for public health as related to toxic substances. So it's kind of unique that the citizen can actually reach all the way up to the federal level and actually get a hold of us, and we can address some of their public health questions. So we predominantly consult on environmental health issues. We are not a regulatory agency, but we are we respond to and provide public health recommendations. So we're non-regulatory. And one of our primary goals is to enhance the state health department. We do have cooperative agreements in not all health departments, but we do have cooperative agreements that the health departments, the state health departments, will actually do our public health assessment documents for ATSDR, as well as our consultations. So we're trying to enhance the ability of the states to be able to address their own citizens' concerns, and as they develop that expertise, then they rely on the federal government less and less. So we work very closely with our state partners, and I'll talk a little bit about more specific our state relationships within Region 6. We'll go to the next slide, please. So ATSDR, we follow the same outline as far as the regions are set up as EPA. I'm located in Region 6, which is New Mexico, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas. What you don't see in Region 6 is the U.S.-Mexico border, which I do a lot of binational work on the U.S.-Mexico border, as well as in Oklahoma. We have quite a few tribes in Oklahoma, so we also do a lot of tribal work in Oklahoma, as well as some of the other regions as well. So in each one of the ATSDR regional offices, some of us are co-located with EPA, and some of us are not. In Region 6, I am co-located with the EPA, and I'm actually on the same floor as the Emergency Response Center. So anytime there's an environmental disaster in Region 6, I can, within about 10 steps, be in the Emergency Operations Center and provide any technical support to the Federal On-Scene Coordinator if they need support in addressing public health questions in working with the community and the states. So I'm very accessible in Region 6. Next slide, please. So jumping right into the poison control centers. In Region 6 is a little unique, similar to California and Florida, in that we have multiple centers. You'll notice the red dots in Texas. Texas has six centers. They are all interconnected, and what I mean by that is that if the Poison Control Center in El Paso receives a flurry of calls from, say, for an example, a mercury spill in a school, and a lot of parents call the Poison Center and their lines fill up, whenever they reach the maximum capacity, those calls are forwarded out to another Poison Center within Texas. So when you see the six red centers, those are all interconnected. So if one center fills up, it'll roll to the next center and so forth and so on until you actually fill up all of the six networks. The other states in Region 6, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana, they have a blue dot. Those states do not have rollover capacity. So if there is a surge of calls requesting assistance from those states with the blue dots and those poison centers, you just get a busy signal. However, they do have mutual agreements within each one of the centers, is that if a fire happened inside the center or the lines were cut for an unknown reason, they have the ability through AT&T or the phone system to be able to transfer calls to another state. One of the downsides of transferring those calls to another state is that you can answer the public health questions and the medical questions. However, it goes into their system, and when the states come back, it's real difficult to get that patient record information. So they don't have state-to-state agreements in Region 6. So I learned about the Poison Control Center's role in emergency response and preparedness during the Space Shuttle Columbia disaster. And a lot of citizens were actually calling the poison centers because the news media reported that a lot of the debris was toxic. And, of course, the citizens that called, they didn't pick it up. It was their dog that picked it up. So they were calling about a lot of veterinarian questions, and I'm sure a lot of people picked up debris material, but they were very concerned because of all the exotic materials that were on the shuttle, and we just didn't know what the hazards were. That was the first time that I really learned about poison control centers and their ability to answer public health questions immediately when citizens call in. And subsequently, I ended up doing a detail to the North Texas Poison Center for about 3 months to get a better understanding of actually how and where poison centers might fit in a hazmat incident. So we'll go on the next slide, please. So what's this all about? In conclusion, the poison centers want to be a part of the response. They want to be included. They have expertise. They do this for a living. They're 24 hours a day, so they have a lot of expertise available. But the problem is that they're not being invited to the disaster. And so I've been looking at ways to include the poison centers and actually get them engaged in the process so they can be a viable player and they can be invited to the dance. That's one of the reasons I did the detail, is to kind of learn more about how they manage a program inside and what we can do to start implementing those programs. So I'm going to walk through some of these additional slides with you and kind of give you a little bit more about the background and some of the mechanisms that we put into place here in Region 6 to actually start bringing the poison centers into to the response. Next slide, please. So a little bit of background on the RRT. I didn't want to go into great detail. However, I did want to put a link for folks if they want to check out the RRT a little bit more detailed than what I'm going to cover. Here's a link for you. But the RRT is part of the national of the regional response team, and I put up also the JRT, which stands for the Joint Response Team. That's between U.S. and Mexico. The RRT, and I'll show you on the next slide, and all the partners that participate, the regional response team, they're addressing hazmat and oil-related activities, spills, and disasters. The RRT is co-chaired by two programs, one the EPA and one the Coast Guard. So if it's a navigable waterway or coastal spill, like you saw in the BP spill, then the RRT chair would be the Coast Guard. If it's an inland event like a Space Shuttle Columbia event, then the RRT lead would be EPA. So it just depends on what the disaster is. And then the joint response team is between U.S. and Mexico, and that's dealing with the Mexican Navy and depending on also, too, if it's inland or coastal with the JRT. So here's the link to it. To find a little bit more information, more details about the RRT, because I will talk about the RRT in creating this document that I provided earlier. So we'll just move on to the next slide, please. So for us in Region 6, these are the members that make up the RRT. And you notice in the top right-hand corner, we were able to add the Poison Control Center. If you look at all of the folks that are on the RRT, one of the things that's missing that you don't really see is state health, and state health departments are not on our RRT. We have DEQs, the Department of Environmental Qualities, from all of our Region 6 states, but we don't have state health departments. And that goes back to the RRT legislation and the regulations that you saw, because the DEQs, the Department of Environmental Qualities, are they're written as a member of the RRT. However, the health departments are not, and health departments can attend RRT meetings, but they're not voting members. So most of the RRT that you have, you do have HHS that's there at a very high level. It's usually a regional emergency coordinator, but you get a lot of high level public health support, but you don't have a lot of state health support in the RRT, with the exception of the recently added Poison Control Center representatives that do and attend our RRTs in Region 6. Next slide, please. So just a little bit of background. When I mentioned those red dots in the six centers that they had in Texas, these are the areas in Texas. So if you're in one of these counties and you dial the 1-800-222-122 number with the Poison Center, you'll be rolled to that particular Poison Center. They said it was interconnected, and so I was like, okay, well, let's see how well you guys are actually connected. EPA had a binational exercise in Eagle Pass, Texas. It was a hazmat incident that they were engaged with Mexico, and they were basically sharing resources on a hazmat event. So I asked them if we could also maybe put in a little bit more of a public health spin, and everybody agreed. So what ended up happening is that we used the city employees of Eagle Pass to have a call down sheet and actually surge the Poison Center at a certain time and just flood them with calls. So all the calls that actually go to San Antonio, and what we wanted to be able to do is to surge all the centers and tie them all up and actually see if in fact they could handle, say, 100 plus phone calls within 30 minutes to an hour. And I wanted to get an idea of whether or not this is actually true before I was going to advocate for EPA and the federal on-scene coordinators to actually utilize poison centers during a disaster. So I wanted to test it out first, and I was quite surprised. If you go to the next slide, please. They were able to accomplish this surge. They thought it was a joke because they've never had a exercise. The poison centers have never had an exercise with their centers. They never surged the six centers before, never tested it. in theory it worked, but in practicality, and this has never been done since poison centers were established like 1958. So they've never really had this. So the call center, they were kind of surprised and shocked. They didn't think that it was serious because most of the calls when they came in, they would caveat the call and say, this is an exercise, this is an exercise. On this chart on the call distribution, you can quickly see the number of calls that were received and what poison centers was able to handle the calls. So they managed like 137 calls within less than an hour. So that was quite impressive. They got really upset with us for doing the exercise because we interfered with them actually treating medical clinical cases, and because we tied up all the lines within that hour was not free for actual patient care. So they weren't happy with us, but I had to do this to see whether or not this was truly a resource that would be of benefit. So for us in Region 6, to have a network with six centers that they can handle this surge in a short period of time was extremely impressive. Next slide. So the Eagle Pass exercise, this is just to kind of quickly show how fast they were able to gear up. And one of the things that in the exercise that we wanted to accomplish is that whenever we established the exercise, the poison control centers in Region 6 are aware of EPA. They're aware of the term OSC or on-scene coordinator. So whenever an OSC calls, the poison centers have a notification system that they're going to notify me because I have a relationship established with them. But during our exercise, this just kind of shows you how quickly, with the time we had the exercise at 7:30, the poison centers provided an update to EPA about 10 o'clock. So that's pretty quick turnaround in a disaster response. So I was very impressed with their ability to be able to get back and update the EPA on the number of calls that were coming in and what some of the concerns were associated with the disaster event. Next slide. The RRT and the members that you've seen, I presented a concept to them about utilizing the poison control centers more in disaster preparedness response. The RRT, and I shared with them the Eagle Pass exercise and demonstrated the utility. So the RRT asked me to develop a guidance document, and I pulled together a team of stakeholders that's listed within this document. You all have a copy of it. And in short, this document basically says to call the poison center at the 1-800 number 222-1222. And it goes into a little bit more detail within the document on why and what their role is. It's fascinating in doing this and putting this document together for the RRT members. The RRT members were similar to me in that I really had no clue what the poison control centers could do. And the irony is that if you talk to any mother or a mother with elementary children, they all have the poison center number on their phone and on their kitchen. So if their children swallow something or their dog gets into rat poison or something, they can call the poison center and they know it by heart. However, their husbands who work for EPA or FEMA or ATSDR really don't know to call poison centers in a disaster event. So it was fascinating to catch all of the practitioners up to speed on what really the poison centers can offer. So you have a copy of that, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions that anybody has on the document. I've gone through like 14 revisions. I think there's number 13 here on this slide here, but I think you have the latest revision. If there's any comments or questions, it's a living document. I'm happy to incorporate anybody's comments and revisions and any updates at all. So next slide, please. So within the document, I know it's kind of confusing. If I had a pointer, I could probably point this out a little bit, so I'm going to have to walk you through what all this means. If you look on the left-hand corner, there's a little red star that I have listed as an industry or hazmat event. I kind of want to explain how some of this unfolds so you may get a better idea of where poison centers might fit in. So I'm going to explain this two different ways. The first way I'm going to explain how industry reports it. So you have a hazmat event on the left-hand side. There's the little starburst. The industry has, by law, a requirement that they have to report to the National Response Center and on their spills. And the National Response Center wants to know, one, you know, the amount, and two, has anybody been injured or is there any deaths? So that information is collected by the NRC. The NRC, National Response Center, sends out an email notification to the DEQs, the Department of Environmental Qualities, and state and local response. At the same time, they also send notification out to the EPA. And for this particular slide, I put EPA Region 6. So we will get notification here in Region 6. EPA will. So ATSDR will be made aware of any public health activities, and if EPA needs any support, through EPA. If the disaster is beyond what EPA can handle and they need to convene the RRT, like in the BP oil spill, they will convene the RRT and they'll have an RRT activation. If you look down, when the EPA Region 6 response center is activated, you'll have a phone duty officer and usually a federal on-scene coordinator that is on duty. And that federal on-scene coordinator will be the recipient of that event, and more than likely they will be the point person to go out in the field and follow up with the response if it's warranted. So in the middle we have an EPA or Coast Guard OSC assigned. So I kind of put two yellow arrows together. I put a new activation linking the EPA OSC to the Poison Control Center. And then I created a bigger yellow line connecting the RRT and the Poison Control Center with the activation guidance document that I mentioned earlier on the other slide. So what happens is that when you now engage the federal on-scene coordinator contacts the Poison Center and says, hey, you know, there's been a train derailment with methyl ethyl death. You know, the population's 100,000. Heads up, I'm going to give you any environmental data that I have. You know, you may start getting calls from the public. So the Poison Control Centers are made aware of the environmental hazmat situation. The Poison Centers, whenever the spies are typing in their computer and helping out doing patient medical records, and whenever anybody calls, they're generating a medical record. And once they complete that record and they hit enter, it goes to the state health department. So the state health department is aware of what's being generated by the poison centers. And when the state health department gets the information, it also goes over to CDC and ATSDR in Region 6, we're alerted, as well as CDC. And so CDC and Royal is going to talk about this more nationally on how CDC kind of looks at these emerging events. So you start pulling in the public health piece when the OSC gets engaged with the Poison Control Center. And then the CDC also has, through it, NCEH, data surveillance. So they're constantly monitoring Poison Center data nationally. That's how come if you have an event down in El Paso and you have a surge of calls that come in from El Paso, you can very quickly get CDC experts calling the state or calling down to the El Paso, the city of El Paso, to say, hey, we noticed you guys had a, you know, mercury upset with a lot of kids that are exposed to you needing support. So they're going, how do you get this information? And it's through this Poison Center data surveillance. Now, going back to the original industry hazmat event, the 24-hour event, notice the green circle. So that's one of the key pieces that we've been leaving out, is that when you do have a disaster event, the public also calls the Poison Center. They call them quite a bit. Even right now during our West Nile event that we're having here in Dallas and as well as in Oklahoma, the Poison Control Centers have received over 1,500 calls since I think August 13th to address all kinds of concerns that the public has. So what's interesting now is instead of industry reporting to the NRC and going the route that I just explained, by developing this relationship with the Poison Centers are actually calling me, the ATSDR regional rep, before the NRC reports to EPA. So then I can walk over and talk to EPA, Federal Launching Coordinator on duty, and say, hey, I understand there's a train derailment, and this is a particular chemical that they're, that has been released to the public. Are you aware of it? And they are kind of surprised that we get this intel. Why? Because the community members are calling the poison centers in. So we've now developed that a little bit faster relationship. Okay, next slide, please. Within the document, I asked EPA to kind of help me where they thought under the ICS structure where they thought poison centers might fit. I know this slide is probably hard to see, but we got a federal on-scene coordinator underneath them. In the middle of the slide is a little triangle I'm looking at. You also have a state and a RP, which is a responsible party. Off to the left of that, you'll see where we thought that the poison control centers would fit under that ICS structure. And then I pulled this slide in to kind of also highlight on-scene coordinators lead for inland spills and also the Coast Guard. Just wanted to reinforce that for navigable waterways or the oceans, it's the Coast Guard is the lead. Next slide, please. Within the document, one of the key tools that we were able to generate, and this was something that we learned from EPA, is their situation reports. I know the state also does situation reports. They call them SITREPs for short. During the BP spill, one of the ways to we from a public health perspective, there was not a lot of folks showing up at the hospital, so there wasn't very much surveillance data from hospitals, very little. We did have initial deaths from the event, but not a whole lot of hospital visits. So you really couldn't tell what was happening or what the community's concerns were. We started working in integrating poison control centers to be able to address some of the public's concerns. And so we were able to monitor every day through these SIT reports, and this is an example of how a SIT report might look. To highlight daily what's going on. In this particular one, we're actually capturing Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. And we're looking at human exposure calls. We're also looking at animal calls, if my animal got into it. And what was interesting is that during the response, because there wasn't much surveillance generated from the hospitals, the responders and emergency planners all wanted to kind of get an idea of what's going on with the general public. So I was fielding these reports daily and sending them through HHS. They were ending up at the White House. A little funny story. Dr. Mark Ryan with Louisiana Poison Control Center director, I asked him to do these SIT reports every day and send them to me. So after about 25 of these, he kind of says, well, where are these reports going? And I said, I'm briefing them up, and you all know as well as I do how emails travel very quickly, and I don't know where they're going. They're just going out. So he says, well, what if we don't do one? And I said, well, fine, don't do one. It doesn't matter to me. So he didn't do one, and I got a call the next day, and they wanted to know where our poison control center report was. And I said, well, who wants to know? They said, the White House wants to know. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, I called Mark back, and he was kind of surprised that the White House was looking at the reports. But I think you all can see the value of being able to have daily information and surveillance during an emerging event is of extreme value. Next slide, please. So our poison centers in Region 6, our directors, felt very important about developing the relationship with the RRT and developing the relationships with the Coast Guard and EPA, that they all traveled down to an RRT meeting and did a presentation and showed up in force to be able to say, hey, we're here. We want to be a part of the dance. We want to participate. We want to be able to help you out. We want to help the community out. You know, please utilize our expertise and our resources. So I was very grateful and very fortunate to have our poison centers in Region 6 lean forward. They did this on their own dime. The RRT guidance document, the poison center's willingness to participate, this was all accomplished with the poison control center's willingness to want to work with us without any funding. There was no dollars dangled in front of them. They know that if they're underutilized, that they'll probably go away, and they need to be utilized. They're a huge asset and a great resource. So I was very fortunate to have them participate in our meeting and show force. Next slide, please. So just a couple outcome and health impacts. We were able to test the poison center network first time ever, which involved six centers. So that it works. I wish that because we have 10 centers in Region 6, that in my future thinking, I would love to have 10 centers be able to turn on. Or if you had a national disaster, and we have, I think, somewhere around 57 poison centers, Royal might be able to correct me on that, but to be able to stand up all poison centers to be able to handle the public calls would be a huge asset. Currently, that doesn't exist, but as funding comes available, maybe that's something that folks may be able to think of a little bit above my level. We have developed a new relationship between the poison control centers and the environmental regulatory agencies. We've developed a better relationship with the DEQs, the Department of Environmental Qualities. I can tell you that I was mentioning the National Response Center sends out the spill reports to the DEQs. Well, in Arkansas, the Poison Control Center gets them the same time that the DEQ does, and so they're able to screen these spill events, and they have an idea based on what the material might be whether or not they're going to get any calls. And so they're already up to speed, and the DEQs really appreciate that quick resource for them. And we have the same thing in Oklahoma, Texas, as well as Louisiana. We've increased communication between the federal on-scene coordinator to enhance environmental sharing. That's always a real difficult activity if you have data and then you have to make sure you have, you know, QAQC, but in a disaster, you know, we need information now. And so we're trying to develop that trust so that way the poison centers, if they get the environmental data, they know where the hazards are at. They actually treat patients at home. That's the reason why they were created. For $30 phone call can treat a patient at home. And if a patient calls in and the poison centers know where the environmental material is at, if they know where maybe the plume went, they have that environmental data, then they can have a better response back to the community and be able to say, no, you don't need to go to the hospital. You're fine. You're not within the plume. You'll be okay. Or if they see, you know, residents that are in an area that has been exposed, then they can direct those patients to the hospitals. So we've developed that a better working professional relationship. We were able to also generate guidance document at the request of the RRT for the RRT members to have a better understanding of how poison centers work and when can they use them and how can they stand them up, and that's that living document that I'd mentioned. And some of the health impacts, I didn't go into a lot of detail. There's a little bit more detail in the document, but from the health side, you know, in a nutshell, it's free health care. It's 24/7, and that 1-800 number is a national number. Everybody on the call should take their phone out and make sure that they write that number in. You can use that at any time if you have any questions at all, you can call the poison centers and they can triage it. I think some of the reluctance of some of the professionals, emergency manager types, to actually understand and use poison centers, I think they think it's a call center. It's actually the poison centers are manned by physicians, pharmacists, nurses. They are working professionals that are licensed to make healthcare judgment and advice also to clinicians that maybe they don't see too many of the hazmat incidences. So you should make sure that you keep that number in your phone or memorize it. Some other health impacts, we improved the public health response through sharing of critical information. I kind of said that on the outcome of environmental data. So PCCs can handle technical medical response activities much quicker. For hazmat incidences, because of the use of poison centers, we can actually reduce the surge of patients at hospitals. Like I said, poison centers have the ability to be able to treat people at home. So if citizens know to call the poison center for information on whether or not they should report, and realize some of these citizens may or may not have insurance. That's always an issue. And if you don't have insurance, maybe you're less reluctant to want to go to a hospital, but you still would like to have some reassurances from the medical community, and the poison centers offer that. The additional health impacts is that we develop relationships between the ATSDR regional offices. So from the federal level, I can quickly share with our poison center directors in Region 6 emerging trends, and as well as they share with us emerging trends that they see from citizens calling the poison centers. For us, ATSDR, we don't deal with occupational exposures. We have a sister agency, probably most of you all are familiar with NIOSH. NIOSH handles our occupational calls. One of the health impacts is that the poison centers have the ability to address occupational exposures as well as non-occupational. So we can quickly engage poison centers if there's occupational questions for them to get a quick immediate response, and then obviously we can always tie in NIOSH in the future. We also have the ability now to, for public health impacts, to actually improve the data quality with the state and the national surveillance that Royal's going to talk about. If we get the poison centers engaged quicker and if they are engaged in the dance, I will say, earlier, it just improves the data that's going to be generated on the outside and looking at it more from a larger picture. I think Royal's going to really highlight that for us. And that's the end of my presentation. I thank you.
Okay, great. Well, we do have a number of questions that have been submitted electronically in the queue. And before I turn over to those, I'm going to go ahead and allow those of you who are joining us via telephone to feel free to ask a question out loud. So if you are a telephone line participant, you can certainly take yourself off of mute. If you used our command, it'd be #6 to unmute your phone line or simply unmute your line using your button, if that's what you did earlier. And feel free to identify yourself and organization or your name, if you prefer, and if you'll make your comment or ask a question. Okay. Well, in the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and start reading off some of the questions that have been submitted electronically. You can continue to type up your questions and comments as I go through these, and we'll get through as many as we can in the allotted break, and then again, we'll have more time before we close things out if we don't address everything just now. So the first question, I'm going to start just in the order that I received them, is coming in from Arlington, Virginia, and they reference all the way back to slide number 5. And on that slide, they ask if the hierarchy, what exactly is being shown on that slide? Is it the hierarchy of their agencies and their reporting, or is that somehow showing a change in agency names over the years?
Yeah, it's both. It's a hierarchy. So we are under the Department of Health and Human Services, and then the hierarchy, ATSDR actually reports to CDC. CDC reports to Department of Health and Human Services. The recent change is a merger between the two different agencies, NCEH and ATSDR. We were combined, so we merged together as basically one unit with one administrator for both ATSDR and NCEH.
Okay, great. Thank you. Our next question comes in from Washington, D.C., and this one might be a little bit harder to answer, and I think you may have touched upon it a lot throughout your examples, but they actually ask, how does ASTDR work with the EPA? Do you advise EPA, or does EPA provide input to you?
It depends. We provide public health recommendations to EPA. We're not a regulatory agency, so we can only provide advice and recommendations.
Okay. Our next question comes in also from Virginia, and they ask, are poison centers state-funded, or do they receive funds from the federal government?
Great question. It's checkerboarded. The poison centers receive federal funding from HRSA. I believe it's Healthcare Resources Service Administration. They also receive some funding through purchasing of data. That purchasing of data can come from a federal agency. I know the American Association of Poison Center data is very expensive to have the whole entire national database. That's an expensive fee to be able to have all that information, and so they sell that data to those interested parties, and that money is trickled back to the poison centers. Individual poison centers also have contracts that they have established with private industry. For example, in Texas, they have an agreement with Mary Kay Cosmetics for dollars to be able to tell them what cosmetics the children are getting into. For the BP spill, I learned that the Poison Center also has contracts with oil companies to be able to handle their medical clinical calls should a disaster happen. The states can also provide funding to the Poison Center, so it's real checkerboarded on where their funding streams come from.
Okay, great, thank you. Our next question, I think it's more of an exclamation as opposed to a question, but it's referencing slide number 11. And they ask, how can you manage all of the groups that are shown on slide 11? are there really that many groups in Region 6 that deal with hazardous responses?
Yes. The RRT members, all these members here, all these representatives convene in an annual meeting. And that meeting, that RRT meeting is moved from state to state every year. And so they all get around the table. And, yes, we do have representatives from each one of these organizations that is on the RRT. And you'll have these same representatives not only Region 6 but also the other 10 regions.
Okay, great. The next question is in response to the discussion you gave on your surge of the poison centers. And they want to know, will the poison centers do future surge testing based on your exercise?
No.
They never did it.
Yeah, well, actually, that was the first time they ever did it. Arkansas wanted to test their centers. They only have one center. So the director for Hal Foster, with the managing director for the Arkansas Poison Center, went home and he set up a pilot, and he actually tested his staff on whether or not they could handle, you know, a surge of calls. Once you fill up the phone lines, the surge is really over. So basically you're just testing the staff. We don't, other than, the only other centers are, that have multiple centers are California and Florida. And I don't believe that, I think there's three in California, maybe three in Florida, but I don't believe that they have, you know, tested their centers and at the level that we have in Region 6. And then for the rest of the country, they're just one poison center. So there's really not much for testing or surging their system.
Okay. The next question comes in from Arlington, Virginia. And I believe that they're referencing slide 16. It's the PCC activation, the example where you have a graphic showing arrows between different icons. And they ask, is all of the, quote, communication, the arrows between icons, completed by phone? Do you have an online system or dashboard for notifications?
Well, that's a good question. Most of those are through email. There's a fax that comes into the EPA Response Center here in Region 6 from the NRC. So the NRC is the one that has a master list of who is notified, and the Coast Guard manages that. So that's how we were able to get the Arkansas and Louisiana, as well as Oklahoma poison centers engaged with what was happening immediately, and that was the NRC added them through their email notification system.
Okay, great. And then the last question I have online in the queue for the moment comes from Washington, D.C., and I think this is a great wrap-up question. They want to know, are other regions following your example?
No. We presented the RRT guidance documents to the National Response National Response Center, the NRC in Washington, D.C., and we shared what we were doing in Region 6. Our RRT members would like to share that with other regions. I think the approach was there's going to be a national coordinators meeting of RRT members that meet once a year, and to share this resource with them. That has not occurred. I try to stay within my borders. I try to stay within Region 6. But for right now, the Region 6 is the only one that kind of has this relationship established with their poison centers. Region 4, ATSDR office does have a relationship with their poison centers in Region 4, but they do not have guidance. And a few other ATSDR offices, but not very many, have relationships established with their poison centers. That would be something for us to look at in the future.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let's check one more time to see if anybody on the phone lines has a question or comment. Remember, you need to unmute. You may have to use your own mute button or hit #6 if you'd like to ask a question. Okay. Well, I'll just extend my thanks to Patrick for that presentation. And I'm going to go ahead and move on to our next presenter for today's session. If you do have other questions, though, that pop up for Patrick's portion of the talk, you can continue to submit those in the online queue. And again, when we get to the final call for questions, we'll go back to anything that we may have missed from earlier. But with that, I'm going to segue over to slide number 22, and I'm going to turn things over to our second presenter today, Royal Law from the CDC's National Center for Environmental Health. Royal?
Thank you, Jean.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Was there another question? No?
Nope, we got you.
Okay, thanks, Jean. And thanks, Patrick, for that great presentation. I just want to reiterate what Pat said, and, you know, thank you for the opportunity to present some of the work that we do here on the national level. I'm just going to take a step back from Patrick's presentation and kind of give the national flavor to what we do with the Poison Center data. And as Jean said, I'm on slide 22, and I'm moving over to slide 23. So, you know, before I start talking about our national system, let me just give a brief overview of poison centers in case anyone is unfamiliar with poison center operations. So, you know, poison centers operate on a toll-free number available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's 1-800-222-1222. And they are there for any inquiries about chemicals or poisons or pretty much anything healthcare-related as well. And the number can be used by anyone in the United States. And calls are routed to any one of the 57 different regional poison centers that serve the Pawnee area. So when someone makes a call to a poison center, these calls are taken by healthcare professionals with specialized training in toxicology. They're called specialists in poison information. We call them SPIs. And these providers are usually, as Patrick mentioned, they're toxicologists, they're registered nurses, and they're pharmacists, so they're regularly trained and available to provide accurate healthcare information. And their job is to provide information if the caller is asking for information just such as, you know, identification of a drug or asking about active ingredients of the pesticide, and we usually call those information calls. They provide exposure or case management if the caller reports an exposure to a hazardous substance, and we call these exposure calls. And usually the main thing is to determine whether the caller needs to be referred to a emergency room, or they should recommend that the caller calls paramedic, calls the ambulance. So they then, the poison centers collect and code all the call data using nationally standardized protocols, and then all this data is uploaded into their regional poison center servers. And so just to give you a sense of how often poison centers are called, just in 2010, there were over 4 million calls to poison centers, and about 2.5 million of those were considered exposure calls, as in the caller reported an exposure to some sort of substance. So, you know, every year we get these millions of calls, and within the national database, we've got upwards to, I think, 10 or 12 years' worth of data. Next slide, please. So the National Poison Data System is the web-based data repository for all these calls, and it's a surveillance system for all the calls that come into these 57 regional poison centers. The system is in near real time, pretty much meaning that once the data gets uploaded to the regional poison center, that data gets uploaded to the national poison, and gets uploaded to NPDES within 24 minutes. And so NPDES is owned and managed by the American Association of Poison Control Centers. They own the system, and the poison centers own the data. And so as Patrick was talking about, when they try to sell, sometimes they try to package some of the data and sell it out, and that's one of their revenue streams for the poison centers and for the American Association of Poison Centers, AAPCC. The CDC has been working with AAPCC since 2003, and CDC funds the maintenance, the system upgrades, and some of the surveillance staff. And we have a ongoing contract with AAPCC to have full access to all the poison center data for surveillance and for situational awareness purposes. Next slide. So using this system, we can conduct near-time near real-time surveillance on all the 4 million calls that come into poison centers every year. And we do so mainly for these three main purposes. The first one is improving public health surveillance for chemical poison and hazardous exposures, which is essentially our routine surveillance activities that we conduct on a daily basis, and I'll get more into that later in the presentation. The second is to identify early markers of chemical events with the objective of providing a rapid and appropriate public health response. And the last goal is potential case finding and situational awareness during an event. And I'm going to give some of this, some examples of this later in the presentation. Next slide. So when the regional poison centers upload data into NPDES, not all the data, but a significant portion of the data gets uploaded into the national system. Most importantly, any of the identifying information, such as their name, their callback number, or their address, is not uploaded into the national system. But basic demographic data, such as call location, age, and sex, is recorded. Also included is the time of the call, the poison center managing the call, and whether the call is an information call or an exposure call, that's recorded as well. For calls that are labeled as reported exposures or for exposure calls, the substance, how much of the substance, and where the person was exposed is recorded. The route of exposure and also the reported signs and symptoms, which in poison center terms we call clinical effects, is also recorded here. And then finally, treatment recommendations given to the caller, and then a final determination of the medical outcome of the exposure is also recorded. So usually the poison centers have a follow-up call when there's an exposure call just to see what type of outcome was as a result of the exposure. And that's particularly important on our side, on the CDC side, because we use that medical outcome quite extensively for our surveillance purposes. Next slide. So, you know, just to give you a quick visual representation of the data flow, the general public or clinicians, healthcare professionals, can call the regional poison center, and then that data gets uploaded into NPDES. Next slide. At this point, the regional poison centers and the state and local health departments can access this poison center data, you know, either through their own servers or through NPDES. Some states choose to have a direct link with the poison center, so they have direct access to very detailed case information very detailed poison center data. Whereas some states, they choose to use the national system, which gives a little bit less data, but it's already available, and it doesn't really need much of an IT infrastructure in order to use it. Next slide. And, you know, on the national scale, CDC and AAPCC access poison control data through NPDES, and then we use the system, you know, on a daily basis to conduct surveillance. Next slide. And so, you know, up until now, you know, I've been talking about surveillance, using NPDES to conduct surveillance, but just to give you a bit of context, you know, we CDC defines surveillance as data collection, the analysis, and dissemination of public health information for timely and accurate decision-making and response, and this is one of our main functions here at the CDC. So one of the unique features of NPDES is our ability to integrate these automated surveillance definitions as the data comes in real time. And so in NPDES, there's three ways that we detect, you know, certain anomalies or upticks in the data. Without getting too far into the weeds, I'm just going to give you, you know, really brief description of what these automated anomaly detection abilities are. The first are called call volume anomalies, which looks at any sort of upticks in call volumes of poison centers. As Patrick was talking about, if there is a certain number of calls that are coming in to a specific poison center within the hour that exceeds some sort of historical baseline, we would get that alert as an anomaly. The second type are anomalies in the number of symptoms reported. So, for example, if there was a sudden increase in callers reporting diarrhea and it exceeded that in a historical threshold, then NPDES would identify an anomaly for that specific clinical effect for that day, and then we would investigate as to why there was a certain uptick in the specific clinical effect. And so the third type are called case definitions, and these aren't based on call volumes. These are based on cases or calls meeting a specific criteria. And so anytime a single call matches a specific case definition, MPS identifies that call as an anomaly. And so CDC and AAPCC currently have 11 definitions running that are considered high priority exposures. And these are pretty much used to detect any sort of sentinel event. Examples include definitions for weapons of mass destruction, botulism, nerve agents, arsenic, among a slew of other high priority exposures. And so for all these anomalies, NPS sends out immediate email alerts to our branch and also to AAPCC and to our surveillance staff so that we can look into it for further analysis. And so, you know, what actually happens when we detect these anomalies? So when we get these email alerts, I'm on slide 31 now. AAPCC and CDC evaluate these anomalies for public health significance. And so some of the factors that we use to determine public health significance include looking at the temporal or spatial distribution of the calls, looking at severity of the symptoms, looking at the rarity of exposures. We have a pretty detailed criteria for what we determine to be of public health significance. So sometimes the information that we get in MPDS is not enough to make a determination of public health significance. You know, like I had mentioned earlier, not all the data gets uploaded into MPDS. And in those cases, we usually reach back to the regional poison centers, and they're contacted for additional information. And usually within 28 to 36 hours of the anomaly being detected, we're able to confirm whether there is a public health issue here or not, whether something is a potential public health significance, and then these issues are related to state health departments for further follow-up, sometimes also related to federal agencies such as the FDA, et cetera. Next slide. And so, you know, going back to some of the different surveillance goals that we use for MPDS, one area where MPDS is used particularly extensively is situational awareness for, you know, certain public health emergencies. And so, you know, during known public health emergencies, poison centers assist with the surge capacity and triage calls to alleviate some of the work that on the local public health and also to local hospitals. And just to clarify one of the questions that Patrick was trying to answer, in terms of surge capacity, if certain poison centers know that they're going to get a large surge of calls, they actually have the ability to divert some of those calls to other poison centers. So other poison centers can actually take the calls from another state if needed. And so that's another way that some of the poison centers handle their surge capacity. And so using the system, CDC, we conduct national surveillance of the event in almost real time. And so through MPDS, we identify potential cases. We also identify different trends that might be occurring from the poison center calls. And then any potential cases and trends can be reported to state and local health departments, to emergency operation centers, to whoever needs the information for further follow-up. Next slide, please. And so, you know, I've been talking up until now on the 10,000-foot perspective of, you know, our use of MPDS for surveillance activities. Let me just give you a few examples of some of the recent uses of MPDS during certain events, and especially some of the events where even EPA was involved as well. And, of course, as you know, on April 20th, the mobile offshore drilling unit Deepwater Horizon exploded off the coast of Louisiana, and it resulted in, you know, 11 deaths, millions of barrels of crude oil being released into the Gulf of Mexico. And so pretty much a few days, I think a day after the explosion, the CDC Emergency Operations Center was activated, and we were tasked at the National Center for Environmental Health with providing situational awareness about the Gulf states regarding calls to poison centers. Since at that point, as Patrick had mentioned, you know, the BP hotline was directly forwarded to the poison centers, so anyone that was calling the BP hotline was also, any information that was being called to the BP hotline was also being uploaded into MPDS. So not only did we track, you know, related calls to the oil spill with exposures to crude oil, we also track exposures to the Corex and dispersants that were used, and we also worked with FDA in tracking ingestions of contaminated seafood. And this information was sent daily to the CDC Emergency Operations Center, and then also was sent to the affected states for quick decision-making and for situational awareness. Next slide, please. So I think this graph of the total oil spill calls to the Gulf states is kind of telling of, you know, the magnitude of the situation. I think over the course of the response, over the course of, I think, 4 or 5 months, there were a total of more than 1,800 total oil spill calls that went to 40 different states. 1,160 of them were reported exposures to crude oil, dispersants, or contaminated seafood. And so, you know, this is just an example of some of the information that we would send to the CDC Emergency Operations Center. We also did thorough analysis of the signs and symptoms, the age groups affected, the states that the calls originated from, etc. And this information was essential to the decision-making process for the Emergency Operations Center and the states, and also important in the communication strategy for their response. Next slide. So the most recent large-scale event that we responded to was, of course, the 2011 Japan earthquake and radiological incident. When the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactors first started showing signs of a radioactive release, you know, we at the CDC and the Emergency Operations Center were really mainly focused on the international response, and really the main domestic issue was to make sure that we were screening the individuals that were coming in from Japan for radiation contamination. But once the media got hold of this issue, and then once the EPA RadNet reading started coming up on the media, which showed, it was minuscule increases in cesium-137 and iodine-131, which were the two radioactive isotopes that were involved in the radioactive leak, it became a pretty hot topic issue in the media. And just anecdotally, we saw email chains saying that there were estimated, 10,000 people that were getting radiation poisoning in the West Coast. Certain media outlets were over-exaggerating the effect of these minute increased levels. And so for this response, CDC was mainly focused on the health communication messages related to radiation. And of course, as we would expect, a lot of these concerns from the public and from clinicians went straight to the poison centers, and poison centers immediately starting getting calls about this right after the incident had happened. Next slide, please. And so, in particular, there were reports that people were taking, potassium iodide or any sort of countermeasures because they were afraid of these effects of the radiation. People were also very curious about what the real risk was for the radiation. And NPDES was used to identify health communication needs, specifically for potassium iodide, which is a radiation countermeasure that is used to reduce the effects of radioactive iodine-131 on the body. And it was never indicated for use in the U.S. at all by anybody. But there were still reports that people were taking KI or potassium iodide. And we were also looking at ingestions of other iodine-containing products. And, of course, we were also looking at people that were concerned about radiation in general. Next slide. And so during the 5 weeks that the Emergency Operations Center at the CDC was activated, poison centers received a total of over 400 incident-related calls. And, many of these calls were really just people asking information about radiation, about whether they needed to take any countermeasures, et cetera. And so we worked really closely with the poison centers to make sure that they communicated accurate and consistent language to pretty much say that the radiation levels were nothing of concern, that they shouldn't be taking any countermeasures whatsoever. On the flip side, the information that the callers were asking to the poison centers were incorporated back to the national communication strategy on the CDC side to make sure that those concerns were addressed on our CDC website, on the CDC hotline, on press releases, et cetera, anything that we were disseminating out to the public. Next slide. And so of these incident-related exposures, we were able to reach back to the poison centers and confirm, or not necessarily confirm, but confirm that they were probable exposures, that there were some individuals taking countermeasures to radiation. No matter how good our communication strategy was going to be, it was likely that there were going to be people that were going to take countermeasures anyways. And so, based on our surveillance, we found 24 callers that reported ingestion of potassium iodide, and there were other reported ingestions of, things that were a little bit more unusual, such as kelp, a report of someone ingesting iodine-containing salt, various other dietary supplements that contained iodine as a means to try to protect themselves from this radiation. And so, you know, the Deepwater Horizons bill and the Japan radiological incidents are just two of the many examples that we use of how we use NPDES on the national scale. It's also important to note that, you know, poison center data is used extensively by state and local health departments for their routine surveillance and emergency response. Next slide, please. Okay, so I'm going to change gears a little bit. I'm on slide 39 right now, so I'm going to change gears a little bit and talk about our initiative over the past 2 years to kind of spread the word out to using poison center data for public health practice and surveillance. So, you know, traditionally, poison centers were relatively independent of federal, state, and local entities, since many of their functional roles didn't really overlap with the public health roles. Their main focus in poison centers, you know, is this clinical case management of exposed patients, making sure that determining whether they needed to go to the hospital or not. But, you know, more and more, especially through these examples, we found that the data collected by the poison centers is extremely useful for public health. You know, CDC uses it extensively to identify clusters of illness. DOT has used it to identify transportation and chemical oils, chemical spills. EPA, as Patrick had mentioned, can use it to identify and support hazmat incident responses. But, you know, over the past 2 years, you know, states and local entities have really picked up on this and established partnerships with their poison centers for data sharing and for open communication. But, you know, nonetheless, there's still this need for increased collaboration between public officials and poison centers. And so we created a community practice for that purpose. And so the poison center and public health collaborations for surveillance community practice was created in 2010 with the objective of bolstering collaboration through sharing best practices, exchanging information, and networking across jurisdictions. And me and Patrick are both leadership team members for that community practice. And so, and, you know, to this end, we have webinars, the highly successful activities and partnerships. We have in-person meetings at annual conferences, and we also have a web-based forum to share documents and to share ideas. And so currently, within these past 2 years, we've managed to have 200 members from poison centers, from CDC, state and local health departments, and also from EPA. And so we've also had the opportunity to, you know, really foster this collaboration and begin to really tackle the tough questions and issues, you know, with everyone at the table instead of just having just a few people discuss with each other and not really having everyone else's opinions, you know, at the table. Next slide. And so something that we also created with this community of practice is we created a forum on www.phconnect.org that lets members post documents and information for all the members to discuss. And so this is a really interesting platform because it's kind of similar to the social networking platforms like Facebook or LinkedIn, in that you can create your own professional profile and kind of send messages to each of the members that are within that community. So we're hoping that this medium can be a more informal and open way to discuss topics, you know, compared to the standard webinar and the standard email approach. Next slide. And so that's pretty much all I have to present today. I certainly urge you guys to, if you're interested, to join this community of practice. We are increasing the members on a daily basis. And if you're interested, please send me an email. I have my contact information here. Also, if you have any other questions about our surveillance activities, feel free to send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, great. I think we're going to take a break to answer some questions. We do have a number of questions that came in the online queue. But before I do that, of course, I'm going to give our telephone line participants a chance to ask any questions you might have via the telephones. So if you're on the phones and you have a question or comment, please feel free to unmute. Remember, you may have to turn off using your own mute button or simply hitting #6. Okay, well, I don't hear anybody hopping in on the phone lines. Of course, we'll take another break before we end things today. But until then, I'm going to go back to the questions that have been submitting online. You can continue to type those in, and we'll go through as many of them as we can in the time allotted. The first question, though, that I've received online comes from Arlington, Virginia, and they ask, do the PCs have translators available, for example, for Spanish callers?
That's a good question. I believe that they do.
Well, I can help you with that.
Yeah, Patrick, can you help me?
Yeah, in In Region 6, El Paso is our Spanish-speaking caller, so the nurses, the pharmacists, the physicians, they all speak Spanish, so any calls in Texas where we have a Spanish speaker, they will be transferred and routed to the El Paso Poison Center. So, and then the Poison Centers also have a contract, I think, with AT&T that they can speak, I think, 44 different languages, so they have a translation service as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I'll ask to extend that. So callers, what about for individuals who might be differently abled, who can't actually speak? Is there another way for them to submit or have the same type of communication?
Good question. I don't know.
That is a good question. Well, recently, certain poison centers have been trying to implement a chat-based system. Instead of calling, they can actually go into a chat room that is from their poison center website. They can actually access a specialist in poison information through sort of like AIM chat log. So that is something that they've been starting to implement. I don't think it's fully implemented nationally, but I think certain poison centers, particularly Georgia Poison Center, has recently been starting to do that.
Okay, great. Well, our next question comes in from Arlington, Virginia, and it might be along the same lines. They ask, is there any thought of a poison, quote, app for smartphones to help with reporting?
Yes, so they've been thinking about that as well. I think this is going to be an extension after they create this chat log. What they're planning on doing is create an app so that people can access a spy through their smartphone instead of just using a computer and chat log. But yes, they've been thinking of implementing that. Of course, it's in its infancy stages right now.
Okay, great. Our next question, again, also coming from Virginia. What do they, and I assume they mean the spies, do when people call about pets, as was mentioned in the Region 6 example? Do they not respond or advise on the call since it's not regarding a human?
That's a good question. So it really depends on the poison center. There are certain poison centers where there actually are veterinarians on call to kind of field these questions. But lately, because of the recent federal funding cuts to poison centers, a lot of poison centers have been forced to kind of forego this service for people and instead kind of refer them to a veterinary hotline, which, from what I hear, are actually where you actually have to pay to get advice. So it's unfortunate, but not a lot of poison centers actually field animal calls anymore. Mm-hmm. But they certainly try to, at least give as much information as possible, not animal-related specifically, but at least try to give as much information about any sort of exposure.
Okay. We do have a supplemental comment that came in from one of our participants from the Texas Department of Health in the Poison Control Program, and they mentioned, kind of along the lines with what you were saying, Patrick, that Texas uses the AT&T language line when Spanish-speaking spies are not available or if it is needed for another language. And they also mentioned that it looks like TTD services are provided for the hearing impaired, so that there are supplemental services if you can't actually call by phone. So great. Thank you so much for that additional information. I'm going to go on to the next question, who comes in from Washington, D.C., and they ask, is your data reported with or using GIS tools? Do you overlay data from the other sources like ERT or OSC responses to spills?
That's a great question. So on the national level, we don't get very specific geolocation data. I mean, the farthest down that we can drill is down to the zip code. That said, though, location data for poison centers is a little bit tricky because it really depends on where the person's calling from. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's where the exposure is. If someone gets exposed to something and goes home and calls, then the exposure location is going to be, then the call location is going to be at the house. And so we in MPDS have GIS capabilities that's already in the system, but just based on my personal experience, that's not really been used. We really just use information on the state level.
Okay, great. Our next question comes in from Washington, D.C., and they state, email alerts for exposure and emergencies implies the use of mobile devices for real-time response. Are you using mobile devices for these types of alerts?
That's a great question, and currently no, but we are in the process of of doing that. Our surveillance team right now gets an email alert, and unfortunately, I guess some part, the biggest portion of the slowdown is when, you know, it just depends on when the surveillance team actually goes in and checks their email. What we're currently trying to implement is to have it so that it gets an email straight to their mobile phone and make sure that everyone has a smartphone so that they can access their email, like a text message. So when something, for example, like a person calls in about a weapons of mass destruction exposure, hopefully we should get that, you know, within 20, 30 minutes of that call straight to our phones.
Okay.
That's a great question. Thank you.
Okay, great. Our next question is from Arlington, Virginia, and this is in kind of regards to your capacity. And I don't think it's, you know, necessarily the numbers. I think they're really trying to get at, you know, what kind of resources do you have available? Because their exact question is, how many spies do you employ? How much surge can you really handle? Can you take 1,000 calls, 100,000 calls? So I'm thinking that they're wondering, how many technical trained staff do you really have available at any one time?
I mean, that's a good question. That really just depends on the specific poison center, and it depends on, so, you know, they have, on, I would say on average, somewhere between, depending on the poison center, somewhere between 2 to 5 different spies working at the exact time. And it really depends on, you know, there are certain times of day where there are more calls coming in. And there are also, you know, restrictions based on funding, and that really just determines how many spies that they can employ at a certain time. That said, though, I mean, if there was a certain incident within a state and that there are a few poison centers that are expected to get a high volume of calls, then the national AAPCC is able to kind of divert those calls along to other spies that might just, you know, that aren't in that specific area that can help with the search capacity.
Okay. And actually, I think the next question is kind of related to that. They're asking, are your call handlers geographically dispersed? In other words, if a disaster struck in an area where a call center was located, and they're referencing the red and blue dots on one of the previously shown maps, would all calls cease to be managed there, or are the spies located throughout the nation?
Can you need help with that call, with that response?
Yeah, sure.
So if the calls happen in state with the red dots, all six centers have rollover capacity. With the blue dots, that just signifies an individual states. Normally those calls will be just only in state for, say, a local disaster. If it's a regional or national disaster, say, for example, the BP oil spill, if the federal response turns and says, if you have any questions, call the Poison Control Center at the 1-800 number, you can be in Florida, you can be in Mississippi, you can be in Texas. If the poison centers are aware of the disaster and they know what the risk communication message is, or they know what the hazard is, they know how to respond to that. If they're clued in. So wherever the citizen that is at, it's going to go to that state's poison center. If we coordinate with all the poison centers, we basically can handle all those messages. All that data will eventually route through the states and end up with CDC.
All right. Excellent. Okay. I have two related questions that have come in, one from Arlington and the other from the Department of Health and Senior Services in Jefferson City, Missouri, and they're in reference to the forums and the webinars. And so the first part is, are these webinars and web forums open to the public? And then the second question asks, can interested parties become a member of the community of interest? If so, what's the best way to do it, through the PH Connect site or by contacting you, Royal, directly?
Yeah, just contact me directly. As of right now, the members include, you know, CDC, state and local health departments, poison centers, and the EPA. We would like to kind of keep this platform for public officials and for poison center individuals only. But we can certainly be open to the option of opening to the public at some point. But yes, if you want to join the community and just send me a quick email and send me a blurb of where you're from, what your organization is, and I'll certainly add you onto the community, and I'll add you onto the PH Connect website as well.
Okay, great. And just as a reminder, I'll be able to point everybody to their contact info. Royal's information is shown on slide number 41, but you will also be able to find that on the seminar homepage as well. Okay, and the last comment that I have is coming in from EPA Region 9 office, and they're just referencing that the poison centers could actually benefit from how the Red Cross has learned to integrate their services on a national level. So I'm wondering if perhaps the poison centers have ever interacted with the Red Cross or there's been some sort of a knowledge transfer between those two groups.
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know, Patrick, are you familiar with that? I'm not actually sure if poison centers have actually integrated with the Red Cross.
No, I'm not familiar in my dealings since 2005 with Red Cross. The state's health department may.
Okay, great. Okay, we'll see if we have any questions outstanding on the telephones. Again, you can unmute using your own button or simply hitting #6. All right, I don't hear any other questions on the telephone lines, and I don't see anything else in the queue.
So
hi. I have a question. Please,
pound. Well, not a question, but actually a request. I was just trying to see if there's any way you can send out the slides after the presentation.
Yes, I will. If you can get to them right now, and before I close things out today, I'll remind everyone how you can get to them. But great.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
You're welcome. So anything else on the telephone lines? Okay. So before we begin the closeout procedures, reminding everybody how they can get copies of the slides, how to access the recorded archives, as well as provide feedback, I just want to give our presenters a chance to make any closing statements. So I'm going to start first with you, Patrick. Any closing thoughts or comments you'd like to leave your audience with?
This has probably been the most questions that were delivered from a webinar or a presentation, so I'm very appreciative of the audience and a lot of great questions. I think that there's a lot of interest in looking out how to maybe expand this out to other regions. So I look forward to seeing this evolve and through the leadership also of Royal and through CDC and expanding it as well nationally as well as internationally. So thank you for the opportunity. I enjoy championing the poison centers. I think they're the best thing since sliced bread, and we use them quite extensively in Region 6. I hope that other regions pick up on what I've been doing and do the same thing as well. So thanks for the opportunity.
Excellent. And Royal, any closing thoughts or comments?
Yeah, I mean, thanks again for Patrick for actually bringing me on to this presentation. You know, I agree with what Patrick said. You know, poison centers are extremely useful for, you know, public health surveillance practice and response. And me and Patrick, as well as many other members within the leadership team, have really been trying to spread the word out as to the utility of poison center data. In the midst of all the budget cuts, federal, state, local, and also for poison centers, we really need to kind of band together and really justify this teamwork and utilize each other's data and efforts to make sure that, you know, we don't really have that, make sure that we can justify maintaining these levels. And you know, poison centers in particular have gotten cut really badly, and which is one of the main reasons why we're trying to put them together with state and local health departments as much as possible so that we can kind of hook them together. So again, thank you for the opportunity, and I look forward to hearing from you guys if you guys are interested in joining this community practice as well. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Well, with that, I'm going to go ahead and move everybody along to slide number 42 and give some closing instructions on how we can access materials for today's event. As we mentioned when we started things today, when you signed up for today's seminar, you would have been directed to the seminar homepage, which is a unique URL that had a description for today's session, has contact information for both of our presenters as well as myself. And there's also links on that same page to download a copy of the slide material. So, again, if you can refer back to your registration emails or reminder email, there are links to the homepage, and at the bottom of that page, there will be options to download the slides as either PowerPoint or PDF files. You'll also find it on what's called the Links or Resources page, and that very same link is highlighted on slide number 42. So if you go there to the additional resources page, the very first item you can download is a copy of the presentation materials from today. You'll also find the Word document that Patrick was referencing throughout his presentation, which is available for download from that same page. If you have any difficulties locating that material, please feel free to contact me. My name is Jean Dallant. My name is all over the CLUIN training page. So you can even Google me online, and it's just dallant.jean@epa.gov. And I'll be happy to forward on a copy of the slides directly. The other link that you'll find on slide number 42 is a link to our short feedback form. It's just a few minutes to fill it out, and we would ask that you take a minute to do so. If you thought this was valuable training and you'd like to see future sessions delivered this way for free, please fill the form out and let us know. I do read each and every one of the responses, so if you had any problems or you have any suggestions on how we can improve these deliveries in the future, that's your chance to do so. If you're looking for credit for participating today, while we don't necessarily offer CEUs or PDHs through CLUIN, you will be able to request a confirmation email if you submit feedback. So when you're filling out the feedback form, there's a box you can check. Make sure your email address is entered correctly, and there will at least be a confirmation message sent to you that will at least verify you did submit feedback following the conclusion of the live delivery. And it's possible that if you keep that, a copy of the presentation materials, and your registration confirmation message, that your accrediting body or organization asking for the credits will take that and actually give you credit for participating today. The other thing is, if you share the line with multiple individuals, when one person fills out the feedback form, there'll be a link that'll appear to allow the next person to kind of sit down and fill out their own feedback form, get their own confirmation message. Both of those links, the resources as well as the feedback form, are found at the bottom and to the side of the seminar homepage, and they will be active indefinitely. So if you're not at a computer right now, you can go back and fill them out and access those resources tomorrow, next week, whenever works for you. Today's session was recorded and will be available for free download and replay in approximately 1 to 2 weeks. You will automatically get an email from me with the information on how to access the archive. Again, you'll be able to pull down a copy of the slides if you'd like as well. You'll also be welcome to forward that archive on to anyone that you think will find it useful. There also are about 475 archive sessions available right now on CLUIN over the last 12 years of our live online delivery, so you're welcome to take a look at those or even look for us in iTunes for our podcast. I'll go ahead and move everybody along to slide number 43. This is just a little bit of an advertisement for us here at CLUIN. We do try our very hardest to work to get technical information out to the hazardous waste community. So in addition to running the cleanup information or CLUIN website, we also do have presences in a number of social media services like Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. So if you want to stay connected and find out about free training like this, look for other conference opportunities, new resources, toolkits, anything related to cleaning up a hazardous waste site, feel free to connect with us or follow with us on one of those social networking sites. So that's the end of all of the announcements and reminders that I have for everyone today. I want to echo my thanks to the entire audience for joining us. I also want to thank both Patrick and Royal for taking time out of their day to develop and actually give today's presentation. I hope all of you that joined us from across the United States found today's session to be useful and that we'll either see you or hear from you on a future CLUIN seminar. This represents the formal conclusion for today's session. I thank you all and hope you have a great rest of your day.